after-dinner speaker, the largely libertarian thinker from the New Zealand Initiative, Eric Crampton. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back to Nights.
Thanks.
Now, you want to talk about the local in government, but before we tackle that, given we've had a couple of Canadians in the country who wanted to make a few speeches or maybe one speech and they couldn't, does this country's treatment, and I'm thinking about in general, not official treatment necessarily, does this country's treatment of these two visitors leave you encouraged, Eric, given you're also a Canuck?
Well, kind of wish for a Twitter hashtag of not all Canadians on this one. Not particularly good representatives of our country, I don't think. But it is a little depressing that we seem to be adopting more American-style political discourse on this one. Until the past month's nonsense, we've had a pretty good civility norm where people can talk to each other, even if they disagree, and even show up riding in a car together. There was a wonderful piece by Emma Espinner last year where she talked about having Don Brash out at the Marae and talking about Maori instruction in the classrooms and his views on that. And he'd been invited there by some of the kids who wanted to have somebody who disagreed with them to hear a broader range of perspectives. And that piece wound up with her driving him home at the end of it. And even though they disagreed substantially on a lot of issues, it was just a wonderful description of the conversation and how people who disagree in New Zealand can do it in ways that aren't offensive to each other and further the conversation to try and find solutions. And it ended with a wish that more people would talk back and forth across those divides to get greater understanding of each other. Now, I don't think that the Canadian and I don't know if the other guy was Canadian or American, but
yeah, I don't know either. We called them Canadians.
One of them was Canadian.
One of them was definitely
Canadian.
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't think that they were particularly sincere in their approach and weren't interested in that kind of conversation anyway. But
I think they were quite interested in the notoriety.
Yeah, they are provocateurs, and I think somewhat fueled by adoption of how things have been going in the United States. A lot of folks watch Twitter and social media on a very strong hair trigger, ready to be really angry and up in arms about everything. And Trump's fueled that in the United States, and there's been a rational response to Trump in that. But we've mostly avoided that here until recently. And the counterfactual in my head is that had they shown up with nobody having much paid attention to them, they would have tried to get more outrageous response. They would have done some media stunts like they did in Australia, where they tried to get people on the street to say, oh, you want these Canadians shot, don't you? Or aren't these? Isn't it terrible that these people are showing up? And they got like no response because nobody had really heard of them, and they just looked pathetic,
yeah.
Right? And you can imagine an alternative version where they had wanted to show up and get the exact controversy that they got. Had we adopted the strategy that we'd seen on the Simpsons, I love the Simpsons. They had a bit where they had on a Halloween episode where there were a couple of these monster billboards that had come up. Advertising was attacking town, and you had a giant Kent Brockman that is smashing a building, and a massive Laramie Cigarettes guy that's smashing another building. And they said, "Well, just don't look, and it'll go away." And it turned out to be the strategy. Paul Anka sang the song. It had a catchy jingle. Just don't look, just don't look. And they went away. They would have tried hard to get a reaction here. And you'd hope that if they had done anything that would have warranted police action, then they would have had police action. But just don't look is a pretty good strategy if you want to avoid amplifying the voice of those with whom you very strongly disagree. So that would have been an alternative. We didn't go that way, and they got, I don't know how many hours of media play, and we're still talking about them, where it could have just gone over as a fizz.
I mean, there's another reason I'm bringing this up now, and that's the stuff that's been on the news today about Massey University cancelling Don Brash's address at the Palmerston North campus, or at least an appointment there. I'm not exactly sure what he was going to do. And the reason I heard reported was, well, they were worried about protests and things getting out of hand. And there is this nagging doubt, this voice that I hear, which is in my head, if you are winning an argument by shouting down your opposition or even just the threat of shouting them down, is that a wise way to win an argument?
Well, it's a pretty dangerous way to win an argument because it means that anybody who is able to threaten a security risk is able to shut down any debate that they don't like, right? So it's a version of the heckler's veto, where if people object too strongly and there's too many protests, then the speaker loses the platform and that conversation is lost. And again, we look back to the alternative variant of it, where in Espiner's version of the story from a year ago, you had a good, productive conversation about these issues at the Marae, and everybody went away having learned a little bit, and it stepped forward. Here, there's no opportunity for that at a place that's meant to be where that kind of conversation happens. That's what universities are kind of for. And where we can reasonably argue that the Auckland case with the Molyneux and I'm bad on the names.
Southern.
Yes,
Lauren Southern.
Where they were pretty disingenuous. Brash believes what he says and represents a reasonable constituency in New Zealand that's part of a productive conversation. Now, I don't agree with him on some of the rights issues, but I try and stay out of that conversation because I'm not really from here. I feel like imposing. But I don't know that we get better conversations by banning those whose views we disagree with, and especially through the heckler's veto.
It's one of the arguments that maybe people will throw at Brash is that he is a little bit dishonest with his facts about history.
And that's where you get a historian on the platform from the university who are asking questions and saying, well, I'm prof of history here, and in my course on this topic, I say this, this, and this, and that's backed up by these sources. What do you say to that? And that you put the person with whom you disagree in a spot where they have to give an answer and respond to their legitimate, sincere critics. And that some of that maybe hasn't happened in other media outlets. A university is a perfect place for it, and we've lost that chance. I don't know what Massey University thinks they're doing.
Let's move on to local government now.
Yay!
But that was a good segue, Eric. Now, what got you thinking about this?
Yeah, well, New Zealand is one of the more centralized countries, and a lot of our national problems stem from a dysfunctional local government and central government relationship. And a lot of that is built on bad incentives facing local government, bad structures within which they operate, bad funding mechanisms. And
we've spoken about this before,
yes,
haven't we?
Yeah. And all of those lead to bad results. Last month, Local Government New Zealand, which is the peak body for local councils, so all the local councils are members and they advocate for local government and try and make the sector better. They also have a few initiatives like benchmarking quality standards across the different local governments to see how they're all performing relative to each other to try and make them all do a little bit better. So they're that kind of a body. They and the initiative launched a localism campaign that's trying to build a better conversation about localism and potential for a more localist approach within New Zealand to allow greater variation of policy to reflect local experience, greater experimentation to find out what works, and greater accountability of government to, well, people in their regions.
Can you give examples of the sorts of services that you think local government could pick up?
It'd have to vary region to region.
Right.
So we're just opening the conversation here. I think a lot of this would have to be very bespoke because there are very different needs in different council areas. In some areas, there'd be a lot of competence and ability to pick up more responsibilities. In others, it wouldn't make any sense for local government to pick up particular responsibilities because the council area is too small. They haven't developed the competence to take it on yet. It'll have to be a lot more bespoke and communities coming to those decisions themselves about which sorts of things would work well for them to take on.
At the moment, local roles, this is off the top of my head, some housing in some parts of the country, Auckland and Wellington, for example, both have council housing. Local roads, waterways, flood protection, waste management, environmental management, public transport. Now, if we just look at Wellington as a recent example, public transport, our local regional council, has been overseeing a major rejig of the bus service. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say, look, it's going to be a few months before we know because new companies are involved, new drivers, new routes, probably new software, new computer systems for it all to bed in. So maybe 4, 5, 6 months from now, we'll know whether it's a better system. But the changeover has been racked.
Yeah.
It's been deleted.
Well, I ride the bus most days, too. It's been interesting, especially with new drivers figuring out the routes and getting direction often from passengers telling them which way they need to be turning, or at least
don't go down that way. You won't be able to turn around.
Yeah, but you don't call local government a fail on one trial that's having a few teething problems. You need to set up the incentive structures so that councils are rewarded for good performance and so that there's a broader accountability as well. So,
well, the theory is they'll be rewarded if they get re-elected. Now, one of the things about local government is that the participation rates in elections, particularly for regional councils, are so low that they're probably taking the chance that, well, either there's this instinctive thing that, as long as we keep rates down, we're probably going to be all right. Unless there's a major, when we keep the roads flowing, we'll probably be okay.
Yeah, that's a
public
huge
transport,
problem.
Yeah, but it's a year out until elections, so maybe it'll all die down by then. I mean, I think that the councillors in this case could have taken a lot more care. So the question is, why didn't they have an incentive to do so?
Well, okay, I came in to talk about localism more generally,
did.
And I haven't looked at all of the particulars on the contracting.
Sorry,
the bus contract.
This is the stuff that's coming up into my head. But I mean, you talk about incentives, what incentive could make this work have worked better?
Okay. The overall structure doesn't look too bad. You've here got a lot of small local councils collaborating together for a regional bus service. They may have had some problems in the setup of the contract. I don't know what the accountability measures were for the company that won the contract around times, how long the phase-in period was going to be for them to achieve performance targets. There are general problems across government, within central government as well, around outsourcing contracts and their ability to set proper performance targets. That's an area where there needs to be capability building, not just at local government level. It's a shared service. We'll see how it pans out. I don't know enough about the specifics on that one. More broadly, accountability does require, though, I think, having somewhat smaller council units. So if we look at Auckland, it's a very big place.
Mm.
One of our theories around how local government can work well goes back to the 1950s and the public finance literature. And there, Charles Tebow identified the ability of people to choose their councils within an area as being pretty important. So competition among supermarkets helps encourage better supermarkets, competition across car dealers similarly. We don't really have competition among local councils in the same way,
Auckland. You live in one council or another, and there's a boundary.
Yep.
And you can't really straddle that boundary. I mean, you might work in one council and live in another. You might own properties in either council, but
We look at Auckland's amalgamation, for example, what happened where we used to have councils that would compete with each other for residents and for rates, and then it all got lumped into one big place, and it's just not plausible for somebody who'd lived downtown to move outside of the greater Auckland area entirely because the commute becomes much too long. Although some people do it, it's not conceivable for a lot of others. If you have smaller units where people can conceivably make locational decisions based on the quality of council services, then that calculus changes a lot because if you provide poor services, then you might lose a taxpaying resident. But we also have to then look at council funding and whether it should just be based on rates or a broader measure of how well councils are doing.
I'll ask you about that in a moment, but are you suggesting that the whole trend towards amalgamation of councils is counterproductive?
I think that we need to have a lot more local in the local governments, that there are ample opportunities for councils who agree with each other and can provide shared services to do so. Wellington's water care, water in Wellington does do that, where most of the local councils share services across water provision because it would be too expensive for any of them to do it on their own. But they can keep to the local level other decisions that make more sense for them to run locally. I really like that kind of a model, and central government has done a bit of work trying to facilitate those shared service agreements. Under the last government, they'd been pushing pretty hard on amalgamation, and they rightly got a lot of pushback. As a second step and a much better one, they were trying to encourage better shared service agreements. Now, the current government has gone a little bit backwards on water provision, trying to pull that back to central government and away from local councils. We should be trying to leave more of these things with local councils, but ensuring proper accountability.
Now, funding of councils, you mentioned rates there. I would say the advantage of rates is that it's quite a strong discipline not to overspend, because ratepayers are the ones who tend to vote.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. That's a good discipline. The problem that we've had with it, though, is the rating system, and combined with how council debt is levied, has meant that Auckland growth is stymied, that existing ratepayers don't want to be shouldering the burden of providing infrastructure for newcomers, and you can kind of understand that. Debt limits have meant that councils can't use that funding mechanism for the infrastructure they need for growth. Phil Twyford has been very good on coming up with alternative mechanisms. And
such
seems
as
to
be, the local fuel tax?
Yeah. Well, that one I'm a little bit more nervous about. But other parts of the urban growth agenda that Twyford has been pushing around, change financing arrangements for infrastructure, look very promising. But relying heavily on rates, and especially rates that are assessed on capital and land value, provides some perverse incentives within councils.
What are the alternatives?
Well, one of the ways that we could look at this is rewarding councils that preside over economic growth. So in a prior report, we talked about letting councils share in the benefits of growth that they provide. So if a council does innovative things that result in central government getting higher company tax revenues, more GST, more income tax, then local councils should be able to share in some of that. And then council can use that to either defray rates, to reduce rates, or to provide stronger services. Then you end up having a broader, more encompassing link between council financing and what's going on in their communities.
One of the things that I'm a bit concerned about looking around the country is some of the examples of councils falling behind on some key infrastructure. It seems to me in Auckland, for example, some of the drainage systems and wastewater systems need addressing pretty soon. I mean, Auckland has not been able to go and swim on it during a hot summer, and some of the beaches is not. You know, that's not ideal. And you could think of other examples of roads around the country or public housing or whatever. And yet at the same time, they might be behind on this already. And then there's this looming challenge, which I think local government is at the front line of, and that is adapting to climate change. Any council which has got a coastal boundary, how is it going to handle that? If sea level does really start to rise, if it's half a metre in 50 years, that's going to involve a lot of expenditure just looking after the land, isn't it?
Or retreating from it, yeah. I think that strengthens the argument for a more localist approach with greater local accountability so that we can see how different councils approach the task and see which ones seem to work better. If you've got lots of councils trying different ways of dealing with these problems, then you're more likely to find better solutions. I completely agree on the infrastructure deficit, and I think that's a strong that's an outcome of the current funding mechanism and of the current incentive structure. Shifting that around to have greater private financing of infrastructure, especially for new developments, to unlock urban growth, and better council accountability so that ratepayers, right now, a ratepayer that's nervous about their council spending money on dumb stuff, exercises that through voting against any rates increases and voting against any council debt issuance.
Yeah, and there are lots of, I can think of people in this city complaining about corporate welfare, the likes of ratepayer money going to encourage airlines to come and land at our local airport. And there's actually another example of that with a local regional air service landing up the road in Kapiti. And I kind of wonder, is this council business?
Well, if you had greater council accountability and you tied these sorts of things to, well, if this actually does pan out for you, we'll give you a bit of a share of the upside of it in central government revenues, but this looks like a pretty risky experiment and everybody else can learn from it if you want to be daft enough to try it. Well, we all get to learn, and hopefully voters within better accountability structures will make sure that low upside experiments don't get tried.
So you at the New Zealand Initiative, and that's what you're part of, and local government New Zealand, are going to be working on this some more, aren't you?
Well, yeah, so the Localism Project was launched last month. The reference group is going to be starting to meet on this in October and November. It'll be taking submissions. You can check out the website on it at Local Government New Zealand to see their approach on it. The initiative is also part of the Local Government Business Forum, which is a rather different approach to looking at local government, and their The Local Government Business Forum has raised some substantial questions about council accountability and making sure that any increase in council powers is accompanied by stronger accountability mechanisms. I think both are important.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us again.
No problem.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, back with more largely libertarian thoughts in a few months.